I can definitely say something that has paid off a lot for me is just being persistent. I did write everybody. Many just never answered. Some said no. And one of them said, not yet. And what I did is annoy him monthly, every month, and say, now, is it possible? Now, is it now possible? Until he said, okay, we can start working on this.
Welcome to the Growth Show. What keeps us driving is what drives you further. This is your hosts, Sebastian Kunz
and Sarah Kaya. Hello, everybody. We are here today with Jan Zapper, who is founder of Paperlike. Well, Jan, I think we know each other from your times at Protonet. Protonet is a startup based or founded in Hamburg, actually, which was also a batch in the Y Combinator accelerator. Later on, you were at eTracker, which is also focused on e-privacy. And now you're doing your own thing, mostly, I think, as a one-man show. So I hope we will get amazing insights. And I think you were also entrepreneurially active before Protonet, with a product also for iPads. So hopefully we'll hear also one or two things about that. Let's kick it off. Jan, if you connect the dots, growth and yourself, how would you describe it?
Well, that's an interesting way of formulating it. Before I worked at Protonet and all these interesting companies, I came out of the uni in 2011. I realized, oh no, it's gonna be difficult to find a job. Put too much energy into finding a job. I thought, okay, let's see if I can start something for myself. And that's when I had the idea, okay, my MacBook is nice, but I have to connect 10,000 things to it every time. So out of the uni, without having had any experience on hardware startups, on hardware at all, I went and started a company to create a docking station for MacBooks, which at that time was a pretty good product, a good idea. Well, I worked for 1.5 years, which ended in a crowdfunding campaign, which then I canceled because I was completely in a burnout. By the time that I got to launch the campaign, I had been working alone at home for 1 year. So by the time that happened, I was completely isolated from the world. Yeah, those are many things that I learned. I based everything on Tim Ferriss's 4-hour work week, meaning that I delegated as much as I could, I outsourced, I did everything I could. But one thing Tim Ferriss never says, or at least it's not explicitly said, is that if you delegate things, if you want to outsource stuff, ideally you have done it before or have some experience with it. I had no idea of all this stuff. So parallel to outsourcing stuff and delegating stuff, I could not even have a good understanding of what's a job well done or not. So I was still taking a billion decisions in 20 different directions, in all of them where I had never had an experience. So just out of the uni, directly to start something like that is a crazy thing nowadays that I think of it. It was sort of, so to say, destined to fail, especially because I wanted to do it alone with the idea of outsourcing as much as I can and get the experts. And that's where many times I would say, when you want to do something so ambitious, at least try to find a co-founder, somebody who can help you out in some specific things. That was a crazy time, burnout. That's where I can say I learned most of the things that I applied in the end for my next project.
Amazing. So I think it's actually also pretty hard to do a lot of stuff yourself. And I think it's also like a big challenge to do that. So amazing what you're doing there. Just so that the people out there have an idea what Paperlike is, what is your product exactly and what makes it special?
Paperlike is a, if you see it very simply, it is a screen protector for iPads. So it's actually, if you completely just see the materials, it's a piece of plastic that you put on the iPad. The special thing that I've done is to fine-tune the surface of this piece of plastic to feel like paper when you use the Apple Pencil on it. In the end, you will have an iPad with an extra sheet of plastic on it that has a specific roughness like paper. And that has many benefits, like it will be more comfortable to write on, more, you will have much more control when drawing, and it has less reflection and stuff like that. And the awesome thing is to hear from customers who say, wow, I finally started using my iPad that has been lying for years. And yeah, it adds that one last step necessary for many people to really love their iPads.
How did you come up with the ideas? Like, what made you start this idea? Was it a personal need? Was it a gap in the market that you found yourself? Or what was, how did this start?
In a way, I would say, if I look back, I've always thought the best ideas ever are the ideas where you look at it and say, why didn't I think of that? That's so obvious. Yeah. Why didn't I think of that? And Paperlike is one of those ideas where as soon as the iPad came out with Apple Pencil, I thought, awesome, I will finally go paperless. Then I went to the Apple Store, tried it out, and in that second, I asked the salesman, so where's the screen protector that simulates paper? Where's the rough screen protector? He's like, nah, something like that doesn't exist. I'm like, okay, that's such an obvious problem. Give it a couple of months, 1 or 2 months. Somebody will solve it. I waited. I didn't buy an iPad because of that. I could simply not write on it because it was too slippery. And then I waited for 1 year, no solution. 2 years, still no solution. Then I thought, okay, let's see if I can fix it myself. And then I started researching the internet, did all the kind of research I could. I started finding blogs and forums where people were discussing which matte screen protector felt the most similar to paper, which showed me that there are other people who are trying to solve that problem for themselves. So then I did my own research and tried it out and found out, okay, a matte screen protector actually does make the iPad feel better. And then that's when I did my own research and contacted a lot of manufacturers who produce screen protectors. I found one that was willing to work with me, and that's still a miracle that he did work with me. But we got to that, we started working on it and fine-tuning the surface so that it is as rough as possible, but not too rough to distort the screen quality too much. So that was the job I did. In the end, what I did is fine-tune that roughness to get the paper quality. As simple as that, that's how I got to it.
How long did that take you to fine-tune the surface to make it feel like paper? Because for the listeners out there, we've just tried this before the recording and it does feel exactly like paper. So how long did it take you to do this and how often did you fail?
The first ever part is the sourcing. That was my experience also with the first with my first ever product. Apart from designing a product, it's about getting the people who can get it to you. So the thing that took me longest was getting the yes from somebody who wants to work with me. So I can definitely say something that has paid off a lot for me is just being persistent. I did write everybody. Many just never answered. Some said no. And one of them said not yet. And what I did is annoy him monthly, every month, and say, now, is it possible? Now, is it now possible? Until he said, okay, we can start working on this. And when we then started working together, it took us 1-2 months until we got the quality that I wanted. But really what took longest was to get this company to work with me at all. And in the meantime, the quality you tried now is the version 2, which is now in development for our next crowdfunding campaign, which took us a bit more of production because it's getting that quality because it's a different kind of technology, which needed a bit more of investment, but that was different because I was already working on this product and this was my main product.
So persistence pays definitely off, I think, is the key message there. I think the other question I have is, and it needs persistence as well, is like having the product and seeing demand through research is the one thing, but marketing it and having actually people buy it is the other thing. How did you market your product in the beginning?
Because I started the Paperlike as a hobby next to my job. I wanted that to work as lean as possible because from the beginning it was designed to be a side project. So everything I did from the beginning was with automation and delegation in mind. And because it had to be automated and with least amount of work and least amount of investment, I did a crowdfunding campaign. So the main first ever way to market this product was to put it on Kickstarter and get the word out to all the bloggers and all that channels that you would have on crowdfunding. Because mainly in crowdfunding, when you're launching a product that's unproven, you don't want to invest any money. So you want to do as much as free advertisement as possible, which means getting bloggers to write about it. So that's what I did, and it worked really well. So for example, after the crowdfunding campaign ended, I wanted 2,000 euro. I ended up getting 60,000 euro, which showed me, wow, this might not just be a hobby. But after that campaign, I kept on seeing this just as a hobby. Going forward, the only thing I did to market the product for the 10 first months is send out samples to YouTubers, to bloggers, to every channel possible. I didn't pay 1 euro in advertisement.
How hard was it for you to convince these bloggers or YouTubers? Did you have to negotiate with the same as with the first producer, or was that much easier?
It's interesting when you do crowdfunding, because when you do crowdfunding, in a way, you sort of have a bonus. Yeah, if somebody says, look, I've got this new product, would you like to write about it? It's different than when you have a crowdfunding campaign. It's like you have this bonus of a time frame. It's more like a story arc. Yeah. They have this challenge, will they make it? And that gives the bloggers, generally the people who write about this stuff, more interesting story, because it's not just that somebody just had an idea. So it was not much about negotiating, it was more about getting the right eyes to see my posts. Because it was my first company and I was unknown in the world, what I did is annoy everybody as much as I could in all the channels as I could. So I sent them emails, I tweeted them, I just wrote the target people in as many different ways as possible until they wrote about me.
That sounds very time consuming to me. Are you running paper like in a one-man show right now, or do you have people that help you with the organization?
Until 2 months ago, I had been doing it alone completely. And recently, I have a very good friend of mine. He, the first time he tried out the paper, like, he said, no way, you can't sell this. Now he is part of the company.
That was easy.
Well, it took 2 years, so to say. Yeah. Yesterday was Paperlike's birthday, by the way.
Congratulations.
Yesterday, 2 years ago, we sent out the first batch. Yes.
Cool.
But yeah, now he is part of the company, and really it's great to be able to know that not everything is on my shoulders. But still, he's focused on the marketing side. I still do all the operations. So I build the processes, I train all the support people, I build all the automation, and that's still the thing I want to focus on, to be 100% lean, to automate as much as possible. So that's why I can do it sort of by myself still. The whole marketing thing will grow a bit with this Sebastian, but yeah.
So you mentioned you did a crowdfunding for your product. You also were there when Protonet did, I think, even two. I think you even see both of the crowdfunding campaigns Protonet did back then, and both were really successful. Could you leverage any of the learnings or things you've seen there for the crowdfunding you leveraged for your own product and company?
Well, in a way, both crowdfunding campaigns, they're the two biggest failed campaigns that I have experienced. Both were great economical successes at the time that they came in, but execution-wise, they ended up collapsing. And that's my biggest learning in that whole process. I did learn a lot about getting the word out, and that was really good. Thomas Reimers, for example, he is a machine of getting people to push it, and he did an awesome, awesome job, especially in the first campaign, where we got 3 million euro within 1.5 days, which is just crazy. Well, it took us like 2 years to collapse completely in the end, but it was a crazy experience to be part of the whole process. I learned some things, like focus on what you're promising and make sure that your customers, the people that support you, get what they want, or at least are informed every step about it. I learned many things that I will do differently. Let's say if I have a big success, I will make sure I don't grow too fast and stuff like that. But it was a great experience anyway.
Yeah, I think that's what many people think. I think the faster you grow, the more successful you are, but I think that's a big mistake. Can you elaborate a bit on the first weeks, month of Paperlike, what you were facing, how things were going, and how you made the first sales and the first 100, first 1,000 sales, just to give our audience a bit of insights here?
Yeah, well, just to make the story round, by the time that Protonet, the company that did these two crowdfunding campaigns where I was part of, they announced that they were going bankrupt. So I started Paperlike at the time that they announced the bankruptcy. So sort of I had the time before the company ceased to give me a job where I just could, next to the job, do the Paperlike. I launched the campaign, got the €60,000, which was actually 3,000 sales. So pure crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. My first sales on e-commerce were on Shopify. So the campaigns, the process was like this. I launched a Kickstarter campaign. I reached €40,000 in a goal, €40,000, 1,900 people supported the campaign. And then to bridge the time between the end of Kickstarter and the actual shipment of the first orders, I did an Indiegogo campaign. Mm-hmm. There's a thing called Indiegogo in demand. Mm-hmm. So you can actually bridge the time between the end of Kickstarter and the actual shipment of the first products. So adding Kickstarter and Indiegogo, that's how I got to the 60,000 crowdfunding amount. In principle, if you want to be a bit cynical, it is simply a pre-order campaign. But it's actually crowdfunding because they're funding the manufacturing. So the pre-order campaign got me like 3,000 units, which we then started shipping yesterday, 2 years ago. And after that, I was still always thinking it's going to be a hobby. So I never really thought about building an online platform to sell it. And one day a friend of mine told me, hey, you know what? There's this thing called Shopify. It's super simple, super easy. And I'm like, nah, okay, I don't know. Let's just check it out on a Saturday morning. Got in on the Saturday morning, took all my text and all the pictures from the crowdfunding campaign, built a website within 2 hours, by accident clicked on activate and got three orders. Yeah.
Wow.
And that showed me like, ooh, how, first of all, how did they find the website? Yeah. How did they find it? Which I'm still not completely sure. I've got the assumption that Shopify sort of pushes traffic to recently launched pages. I don't know. But the thing is that then I got the first orders and then I clicked on put offline because I was not ready to ship yet. But then I was like, wow, that's ready. Okay, cool. So then after I started shipping, I turned off Indiegogo and we could start shipping next day, so to say. And then that was a moment where the real online e-commerce started. It was not a pre-order campaign anymore. It was an actual, you order today, it ships tomorrow. In a way, it was a very awesome accident that Shopify was so easy to set up. I could recycle the whole complete content of the website. Shopify even has a template called Kick something, mm-hmm. like really thought for people coming out of Kickstarter, where the top part is a video where you can even put in the Kickstarter video. So it was really, really easy to switch from Kickstarter to having my e-commerce shop.
So just out of curiosity, since you manage, I mean, you've seen quite a few things with crowdfunding. Did you ever think of doing for your next or second version of your product a crowdfunding campaign again, just to use the marketing kick of Indiegogo and Kickstarter? Because most of the time, what I see is that quite a few of the companies coming or using Kickstarter or Indiegogo as a platform to market the product, they go again back there when they were successful in the first place and they have a new product, so they show it off. I mean, you have already like verified profile that you have a successful campaign, you delivered, so you have even more trust than before. So yep. Did you think about leveraging that again for your new product?
Exactly, that's you're one step ahead of me then. We will definitely do a second Kickstarter campaign for our upcoming Paperlike version 2. And as you say, that's exactly, those are the reasons. We are a proven company, we have shipped, we have a story that people will understand and believe. We have many more customers that have come in the meantime. And by having a Kickstarter campaign, we would even give them the feeling, like really give them the chance to be part of something new, and gives them also a chance to be more of part of the community, not just being a customer, but giving them the chance to support our second campaign gives them a nicer connection to us, which is awesome for us. There's a forum, there's a wall, campaign wall, where they can talk to each other, hopefully be nice to each other and to us especially. Yeah, but yeah, that's one thing. And the other thing is actually, if you talk about the crowdfunding bonus, people who normally would say, okay, you have a new product, nice, buy. If you have a crowdfunding campaign, it is a special different thing. Also because we'll be promoting this campaign to our existing customers, that means we might have a pretty good boost in the beginning. So I'm really curious how the story will be for the people who write about the campaign. Will it be, there's this new version of Paperlike, that's so awesome, that promises XYZ? Or will it be, wow, crazy campaign has a lot of success within 2 days? I'm really curious how that will be. No, it all depends how the how our customers accept the campaign. But I'm really looking forward how to launch this version 2.
So Paperlike 1, your goal was 2,000. What's your goal for Paperlike 2?
For Paperlike 2, my goal, the public goal is gonna be maybe 3,000. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've got a lot of experience with crowdfunding. And this goal that you put on Kickstarter, I mean, people were thinking about crowdfunding about as a platform for marketing a product. And it's very important to understand the psychology of people backing products. Every time somebody asks me what should be my goal for the campaign, I need 100,000 euro. I'll tell them, put a maximum of 10% of what you really need. Mm. Yeah, 10%, 10,000 euro, even less if you can put it down to 5, because most people will not be thinking, okay, are 5,000 euro enough to do this or not? And most people will see the campaign and see how far over the goal are you. And people want to support winners. Yeah, and that's the thing, the lower your goal is, the public number, the higher your success rate is, which then psychologically, it's the same as in the elections. If everybody just voted for the person they believed in, we would see another, a different world.
Yeah.
But people vote for the person they think is less bad, but has better chances to win than the person they think is really bad.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If people don't think it's gonna make it, they might not support it because they're like, 50,000 euro goal, he's at 10,000, I don't know, I will not support this.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the goal will be, again, 3,000. If we get to 20, 30,000 euro in the crowdfunding, it's great. We know that our most important part is then selling on the website. We'll see how that goes.
Cool. You also have, like right now, or in the last few months, you've tried YouTube, like not used, but you reached out to YouTubers, gave them your product, let them try it, even in their videos.
Yes.
And so could you share a little bit more about your activities there and what kind of a revenue change did you see there through these activities?
No, that's actually a good question. My very, very first thing was sending out samples to YouTubers. After I was fired from my last job after Protonet, I suddenly had to live from my hobby, which was a very scary moment for me because by then I was not making enough money to really live out of Paperlike. And I always thought, no, if I put too much energy into it, I'll burn it and kill it. But I didn't expect that. So what I did in that moment is I thought, I can't invest money. I can't spend in marketing. So send out samples. And that's what I did. I looked at all the YouTubers who've ever reviewed an iPad and sent them samples so they hopefully do reviews. And that really made a growth jump back then of times 4. Which was from not being able to live from Paperlike to being able to live from it with a small family. And that was already a huge thing. And that was all free marketing. Yeah, just after the crowdfunding campaign, sending out samples for free. And yeah.
Just to jump in here, did you ask the YouTubers before? Did you just send it to them?
I did write them all saying, hey, have you heard of the Paperlike? I see you've reviewed the iPad. I think this makes the iPad much better. And it works really well. Would you like to try it out? I never told them, could you do a review? I never asked for stuff like that. I told them, here's a sample, try it out. And they could do a review if they thought about it, if they liked it. Awesome. Or if they didn't, I mean, they wouldn't have interest in reviewing it at all.
Yeah.
Yes, I sent out as many samples as I could. I never paid for reviews. It was all free marketing, so to say. They believed in it. They saw that I stood behind my product. If I think of my first pitch of the Paperlike was writing on Twitter, I fixed the iPad. I fixed the iPad, check out how. And that's how I got a couple of blogs. But in the progress of YouTube, for example, yeah, in the beginning, it was all free advertisement, so to say. And then at one point, you had all the rumors of Apple being ready to launch a new iPad. And because I had been in contact with all these people who do reviews about iPads and about Paperlike and all that stuff, I already had a very good list of YouTubers who would be interested in reviewing the new iPad that's coming out. And what I did then is, which looking back, I think it was a really, really smart move. is to know the new iPad will come out. A lot of people will be checking out YouTube to hear how's the new iPad. Yeah. So what I did is write every one of them and an even bigger list of potential reviewers to say, hey, the new iPad is coming out definitely by the end of October. I would love to send you a paper like if you want to check it out, and whatever coverage you do about the iPad, I will sponsor that. And luckily around 10 YouTubers answered and said, yes, we have a slot for sponsorship. There was even one YouTuber who had never done sponsorships, but because he believed in my product and willing to earn a little bit of money next to his normal channel, he said, okay, let's do this. And and I can tell you that in the end, I spent like 10,000 euro in all these different YouTube channels for the sponsorships. Mm-hmm. And that multiplied my revenue by four in that month. Yeah, looking back, you can always say, I don't know, would we have had an explosion anyway because the new iPad was out and people were looking for things like paper-like? But I have got a very good feeling that a very, very big amount of that came from all these people looking at reviews about the iPad. And all these reviews were like, if you know about sponsorships, they have like pre-roll, mid-roll, and end-roll sponsorships, mm-hmm. or package deals, meaning this video is sponsored by Paperlike, and then somewhere in the video, mid in the video, it would then have 1 minute about Paperlike, and then in the end of the video, it would say, hey, check out Paperlike, they're sponsored by. Yeah. And those are package deals. And that's what I did with all the sponsorships, so that it was really in it. And one thing that that I think is a very interesting learning about this is, if you look at it, it was just a perfect, perfect fit. So the video was about an iPad. The sponsorship was for an accessory for the iPad that is purely technical. So it doesn't even have the aspect of, do I like the design or not? That's a nice detail of Paperlike as a product, because nobody can look at it and say, I'm not a leather guy, you know?
Yeah,
true. Yeah? So Paperlike is just like sort of purely a technical product, which improves the experience of the iPad. And so for the YouTubers, it was perfect, because they, in their analysis, you could also see that during the advertisement, there was a 0% change of drop-off during the ads as in the rest of the video.
That's cool.
Meaning that people were not annoyed by the ads because they were so relevant to the video. Yeah, because in general, one thing I've caught myself saying, hey, sponsorship of YouTube videos is great and do it. There is a big, big but there. They have to really fit to the product. Yeah. And that's what luckily was a perfect fit at that moment. I caught that wave of the new iPads, iPads coming out, this big interest peak, and it was a perfect fit. Yeah. So yeah, anybody who wants to learn about this, definitely think a lot about fit. And another thing I've learned in the meantime, because after that kickoff of sponsorships, we've been doing consistent sponsorships with many of these channels. Mm-hmm. And we can see that it brings us revenue over time, and it makes sense for us to continue doing this, even if it's not such a huge peak of interest now. But looking at the videos, at the performance of different sponsorships, one interesting detail is, what is the mind space of people looking at the video now? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Paperlike is a perfect product for drawing. We have sponsored videos of people talking about these drawing apps, which is a perfect fit again. You see, it's about iPads, it's about drawing. Those people looking at these videos will definitely be customers, will definitely be potential customers. But those perform much worse. I mean, not much worse is a bad word. They don't perform as awesomely as these other ones. Why? Because people at that moment are not in the purchasing mindset. Yeah, they're more in the mindset of learning a new thing, a new skill. And that's a big difference, which we have learned. And we're also doing a in-depth analysis of sponsorships to see what makes sense, what makes less sense. That's a luxury position we have now after having many sponsorships and tracking them and to learn, yeah, you know. But mindset during the video is a very interesting insight. What is the mindset of the person? Are they deep into learning? Are they thinking of buying? Are they, yeah, so that's an interesting insight that I've found recently.
I mean, that's actually a great point, because with every advertising out there, you have that issue that you need to have the people in the right mindset. Mm-hmm. If I'm not actively interested right now in seeing a commercial about an iPad, I'm not about to buy it, you know? So you're definitely right. But you mentioned like pre-roll, mid-roll, and the packages. So what I'm curious about is if a founder is interested in sponsoring like a YouTube video or something, like in what kind of a range is a package or a mid-roll or a pre-roll or whatever?
In a way, it depends a lot on the amount of followers that they have. Mm. Yeah, we have sponsored videos that cost us between €50 and €3,500. And they all depend on really how many followers they have and how professionally they are. We work with one YouTube channel. They are super professional. They give us analytics after 30 days. That's why we can see how the drop off was during the video, and they tell us, guys, how awesome is this? We had 0% drop off rate in comparison to the rest of the drop off rate of the video. We're happy to have you as a sponsor because it's not breaking our channel, you know, because for them it's also good to have a sponsor that doesn't reduce the happiness of their viewers. Yeah, so these guys give us the analysis and everything, and they're at 700,000 followers, and they are up over €3,000 per sponsorship, per package deal. Wow. Meaning pre-roll, mid-roll, end of the video. We have with them, we do mostly discounted deals, meaning that we even motivate people to go to our website and even use the discount code. That is expensive, but we have had a modest return on investment. The thing is that you can't track it so perfectly, which is a challenge in the end. You know, just spending €3,500 per video is expensive. Yeah. It feels like a stab every time. But then we analyze it and we say, well, we got something back, and most probably we got much more out of it than what we can see. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, people will not directly click on the link below, or they might forget the discount code, but they might remember Paperlike. So even if at times we say, oh no, that was a loss, I think we've made a positive return every time. Yeah.
Very cool.
But so those are the high end. Then when we go down to 100,000 followers, we were paying around €600 per sponsorship.
Still a lot of money for something that you don't know if it's gonna pay off. So you mentioned that the goal was to get the watches, the audience, from the YouTube video to your website. Mm-hmm. Is the website your biggest channel to sell your product, or is this other channels such as Amazon?
That is definitely a luxury position we have, that our website is the main channel. Yeah, I've known enough people who mainly sell on Amazon, and it's a pure dependency. Yeah. If Amazon suddenly doesn't like you for whatever tiny reason, and you're offline for a month, you're broke and dead. Yeah, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
I launched on Kickstarter, shipped our first products, was on Shopify, and Amazon has always been a side thought. We launched on Amazon, which was an interesting thing, because I always thought if I launch on Amazon, it will cannibalize our website and we will just have much less revenue because of Amazon. Surprise, we launched on Amazon, we had an increase of 30% revenue and a reduction of 5% in sales on Shopify, meaning that some people did go to Amazon, but it was not a complete switch, which was a very interesting insight.
So the people that went ahead and bought it on Amazon were a completely different audience at the end of the day.
You mentioned also a lot that you use a lot of automation tools and stuff like that. Could you a little bit elaborate on that one? Like, what kind of tools did really help you in automating and being more productive and stuff like that? And especially in the beginning, seeing your actual business as a hobby is not easy, because like it's time consuming. So I think you've managed to treat it in the beginning like a hobby, because you've managed to automate a lot of stuff. So what did you do there, and what could you recommend others?
In a way, the not just automation, a lot was about delegation in the beginning. So my first ever step was knowing that I will never pick and pack a Paperlike. Yeah, so that was super clear for me in the beginning, that I don't want to spend 1 second fulfilling products. And that was my main thing, where I realized if this has to be a hobby, I don't want to be the one pick and packing. So that was my first step that made this possible at all. And my partner that developed the paper like with me, he was also doing the logistics and everything. I did it so lean, so lean that in the beginning, the whole automation was Excel and Word.
Wow.
Yeah. So imagine that it was not even fancy software. What I automated is, for example, I did the whole export of all the orders with an Excel sheet, generating order sheets on Word, and then I had a file of 500 sheets that I would send to my partner, and then he would deliver them. Parallel to that, I would connect Excel with my email program with Outlook, and then send all the recipients an order confirmation email saying, "Hey, no, that was for the crowdfunding people."
Yeah.
That was a nice thing when we got to e-commerce, to Shopify, because they automatically did these shipping confirmation emails and all those things. But before that, I did everything with Excel, Outlook, Word.
Wow.
I continued using this Excel and Word process with my partner until at least for 1.5 years. Mm-hmm. But by then, because it had to be on the side, it had to be as lean as possible, I was exporting this once a week, every Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So that it was one time a week that I would export, people would have a 7-day shipping time or a 7-day delivery time. So we shipped at least 7 days after you ordered. Mm-hmm. The delivery would take a couple of days, but that was all clear. Yeah. We communicated in the beginning, but as you can imagine, it was Excel and Word for a long time, and then I realized that I was stopping myself. It was making me less productive, and then we switched to a software called Bilby, mm-hmm. Which connects directly with Shopify. If you look at it, it has become better over time, but if you look at it, it looks pretty outdated and stuff. But it's one of those software solutions that it's so complicated. It has so many features that you can use, that if you really get into it, it is sort of the best thing you can use. Yeah, it's like Excel, for example. Excel can be the worst thing you can have or the best. Excel made my company for 1.5 years.
Crazy.
Yeah, and then I switched to Bilby, which then now works really well for what I need. I'm misusing their features for things that are not made for, but it does exactly what I want. Yeah, so Bilby, an important thing. Shopify, for example, awesome. I love Shopify. One thing that Shopify got me is having a template that simply works. I could just fill out the content. And many times when people tell me, "Oh, I want to launch a company, let's start with I don't know what website templates and website, and I want to have a website that I can edit a lot." I'm like, don't invest any time in developing any website. You want people to understand the issue, you want to describe the issue as best as possible and your product. So take a template that works, and if I can recommend anyone to launch something super lean, go to Shopify, take a template and test.
So that's a lot of good insights from what worked, but now let's take a look from the other side. What was your biggest fuck up or biggest fuck ups and something that went horribly wrong in your career?
What definitely went horribly wrong was my first experience with launching my first company. That was 1.5 years of grueling, lonesome time at home in my apartment, no contact with the world, just talking with the people that I was outsourcing things to and getting questions back that I did not know how to answer. And you can imagine, by then I was reading all the as much as I could, Tim Ferriss' 4-Hour Workweek, which was great. 4-Hour Workweek has been a foundation block of my current success. It was at the same time the destruction of my first company because I was not ready. So that was definitely my biggest fuck up that I'm most proud of.
Okay, Jan, you shared a lot of interesting insights. I'd like to mention some things throughout the conversation that we had. So very funny, if you look back at the very first days, you said you burned yourself, you burnt out, you spent 1.5 years away from the world. But then what really helped you is staying persistent. You mentioned that one of the hardest things for Paperluck in the beginning was actually find somebody who supports you, who would say, okay, I'm going to produce your product. And you kept on annoying him. You kept on being persistent. And I think this is, for every business owner, business founder out there, a very, very important learning. Just don't give up. I mean, you've got nothing to lose, right? And also what you mentioned is make products that people enjoy. We touched this earlier already, but we think this is very interesting to see the approach of actually doing something that delivers value to your audience or to your users instead of just building something or creating something that makes you a ton of money in the long term. What also helped a lot was the name, Paperlike. So I think for everybody out there, find the name that really explains the product as simple as possible. Also, what you mentioned is very important for people who want to market on Kickstarter, for example. People want to support winners. They want to support people that they believe they will make it anyway. If they invest or not, they will make it. So I think this is a very, very exciting learning. I think make people understand that you're going to achieve no matter what. Mm-hmm. And I think this is very, very helpful. And of course, for somebody running a business by yourself or two people or three people, automate as much as possible to make it more effective, to make it more efficient, and also to save yourself some time, right? But yeah, all in all, it was a very, very insightful conversation, Jan. Thank you so much for being part of this. And for the people out there, stay tuned. We'll share the links as usual. And thank you so much for being on the show, Jan.
Well, thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure.